Hello, I'm your host, Erin Gruwell, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast. Today's show is episode number 53, featuring my conversation with actor Patrick Dempsey. Our conversation was recorded live as part of our Toast for Change stream on September 16th, 2020. Our discussion shines a light on Patrick's struggles with a learning disability and the importance of the work that the Freedom Writers Foundation does to provide educators with the tools to give every student an equitable education. I hope our conversation will leave you feeling enlightened and empowered to make a difference. When I first met today's guest, Patrick Dempsey, I, like the rest of the world, watched him weekly as Dr. Derek Shepherd in Grey's Anatomy. His character on the show was perfection personified, but I quickly learned that Patrick's story couldn't have been more different from Dr. McDreamy's. As a teacher, I was honored that Patrick opened up to me and shared something that he rarely spoke about. Unlike his TV character, a celebrated neurosurgeon, Patrick struggled with dyslexia as a child and, in fact, never graduated from high school. So when it came time to find the perfect guest to take part in our Toast for Change fundraiser, celebrating the work that the Freedom Writers Foundation does for struggling students around the world, I immediately thought of Patrick. He was the type of student that we train Freedom Writer teachers for, and I hope that he would be willing to speak candidly about his own personal experiences. When we got word that he was not only excited to take part in our event, but was willing to speak candidly about his struggles in school, I knew that this was going to be a special night. Without further ado, here is my candid conversation with Patrick Dempsey. You have seen him on television, movies, and on racetracks. And tonight we're going to look at him as a child in a classroom. We're going to look at his own family and how they deal with education. And hopefully for all of you teachers, educators, parents, and students out there, hopefully you're going to walk away with a lot of hope. So what I want to do first and foremost is I want to introduce Patrick Dempsey. Many of you know him as Dr. McDreamy to our Freedom Writer family. Welcome, Patrick.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very excited, very honored to be here. And it's quite an introduction, so hopefully I live up to that. but it's great to see you. It's been way too long.
For those that are not familiar with our relationship, Patrick plays my husband in the Freedom Writers film. And that is both wonderful and weird because everybody thinks that I am married to Patrick Dempsey when I am out in the world. So that is a blessing and a curse, Patrick Dempsey.
Sorry for that.
But what I would love to do tonight is look at your career through the lens of how your career has really helped our story, our mission and our mandate. And what you probably don't realize is what you afforded the Freedom Writers was this opportunity to be storytellers, not just in the book, not in the movie that you made, but in classrooms around the globe. And so tonight we're going to be looking at ways that you have helped us and how we're going to pay it forward for us to help others. And so we're going to be celebrating your story while we're also celebrating ours. So I thank you for giving us an opportunity for that.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to it. What a great way to learn.
I wish that one of the Freedom Writer teachers that I've been blessed to teach, I'm still a teacher all these years later, I wish they had Patrick at 5 years old who went into a classroom and struggled. So can you tell teachers what the five-year-old Patrick was like and what that classroom was like for a student who struggled and didn't know why he was struggling?
Yeah, I remember the first moment where I realized I was struggling. I'm not sure what the grade was. It was very early on. And there was an exercise where the teacher had put up the big paper, right? The big yellow paper that you would fold over and they would write. Well, I came in. I just finished recess. So I came in. I had a lot of energy that was blown out so I could focus. But I was sitting further back and I couldn't see the board and I couldn't keep my place. It was basically just write down what's up there on the board on your piece of paper. And it was very hard for me to keep track. And it just felt like as time went by, my mind started worrying about, oh, I'm behind. And then I started looking around and I lost my focus and I felt behind. And that was a moment that was really the defining moment for me in going to school, it was a painful experience. It made me feel bad about myself. It made me feel that I wasn't as good as other people because I wasn't able to keep my place and write everything down in the right time. I struggled with that. And that just came up with the comment that you just mentioned. And, you know, for me, I probably could have done it if I was if I had a piece of paper next to me and I could track it with my fingers and those little techniques, because I kept losing my space. And of course, it would be many years later that I was diagnosed properly with dyslexia. And by then, it was much harder to kind of find the tools and the skills and the teachers that were available and understood what I needed at that point.
I want to go there because as an English teacher myself, I had freedom writers who were 14 and 15 years old who were transferred into my class and, like you, had never been diagnosed. So they too, like you, couldn't write what was on the board. They too were terrified to raise their hand and read aloud. And I always say that sometimes kids are the first one to be picked on and often the last to be picked to be in that social group. So did you face a lot of bullying from other kids who thought they were smarter or wiser? And what was that like socially as well as academically when you did feel different and you were falling behind?
Right. I also wanted to get a lot of attention, right? I wasn't getting the attention. So I would act out inappropriately and was constantly sent to the principal's office for disrupting the class. And for me, it was just really frustrating. And it was a way to avoid the real issue, which was not, it was really such a struggle for me to find the word, to even identify the word, or even read the word, that it just made me feel bad. And I would try to do anything I could to distract. And of course, that became a behavioral issue, which sent me to the office, which then set in motion this, you know, pendulum effect, which then put me into the at-risk classes and then, you know, the special ed classes, and then you're labeled something else. So it progressively got worse.
And I think of all the words that we're using, that just as an English teacher, words have power. So when you think of the word disability, it's
not, I hate that word. I don't want that word.
I have a wonderful friend.
I don't like it.
She likes to use handy capable, but she has really made me cognizant of how we address kids when we call them special ed.
Well, you label, once you put a label on it, then it sticks. And then that becomes your identity. And then it takes years of work to get away from that. And you have to be very careful with that, with everybody. More so with younger kids.
Absolutely. Do you think that you're juggling? I know you are an expert juggler, but do you think that might have been your salvation? That I need some kind of accolades or attention, so I'll juggle and distract so they won't call on me to read. Do you think that was maybe a self-defense that you created?
Certainly. And I think you want to have, at a certain age in your development, teen years, as you know, you need mastery over something. So for me, sport was a way that I could express myself, that I could release my emotions and my feelings. And it gave me something to do that made me feel good. I had a sense of accomplishment. So athletes, and I think a lot of people struggle, they can be really good physically, and some people aren't good physically, and they have the strength to be an academic or something like that, or vice versa. It's like, how do you connect those abilities and go with the child's natural ability and sort of inclination?
I think what I learned, kind of like guerrilla tactics in the trenches, was to go where my students were at. And Sue Ellen, really close. I remember Sue Ellen giving me a piece of paper, and within 30 seconds, I thought she might be dyslexic, just the way that she inverted letters and the way she wrote. And when I said it to her, she had these huge tears, but then it was this, aha, there's a name for it. And maybe there's a solution for it. And we were able to get her help. So what was it like when you heard this word dyslexia? Did it feel like it was an epiphany, or did it feel like it was something shrouded in shame? What was it like for you? Suddenly, the way you processed had a name.
No, it didn't really register until many years later. It was more just like, I'm still struggling with school. Now we have a label, but I don't feel any different. And I'm not seeing any changes other than some exemptions to classes. But still, at that point, you know, they really weren't approaching, you know, dyslexia the way they do now. The skills were not there. The understanding of it wasn't there. So it helped a little bit, but more it was just another label.
what I admire is you, not only were you athletic and you're passionate about your race car driving, which we'll talk about later, but the irony is you chose a profession that is based on words. So let's talk about that. I can imagine for someone who has dyslexia, what you were able to do beautifully is you beat it. You had to figure out a way to take those words in that script and bring them to life in your way. So how did you do that with that very first play, with that very first television show?
It's hard and it's scary and you have to go into your fear. And what, you know, someone once told me, what is in the way is the way, right? Which makes a lot of sense in the sense that what's in the way is me reading. And what do? As an actor, you read. You have to do a reading, a table reading, or a blind reading. So I'm constantly confronted on a daily basis with my shortcomings. And you have to put your ego aside, because if you don't have some sense of humility, it will eat you alive and it will destroy you. And you have to go, okay, I'm going to figure out a technique to get this. It's painful. It's what I've chosen as a profession. It's part of my karmic journey to overcome this issue. And I think there's going to be real liberation if I put pen to paper and I actually write a story. I think I will break through, because I will do it in a way that will not be by the rules, because I can't function that way. I'm going to be doing writing in a way how can I physically and visually express this? And through the medium of television or this, I could do that. But I've never done Shakespeare. To overcome the language and to understand the nuance of it and the rhythm, I've never been able to do. It's one of the greatest regrets that I've had. So certain things I haven't been able to do because of that, and I just haven't had the strength to overcome it, to work hard enough to do it. And that's the big challenge, because it's reading out loud. Table readings are really, when you do a reading, you get a new script and everybody wants to sit around and you want to read it so that the writer can hear. You know, it's an experience just writing it, but when you say it, it may or may not work. And for me, if it's overwritten, I have a really hard time comprehending it. And you want to simplify it. And sometimes that's really good, because you tell the writers, like, you've made your point five times. Can't you condense it and just do and give it almost like a haiku? I'd rather do that. And I've had terrible times where I couldn't remember things, because it didn't connect emotionally to me. It was verbose for the sake of just a writer writing, and it sounded really good for the writer in the room. But when you get up and you try to act it, it gets in the way.
I think every teacher that is watching right now probably has both anxiety that you are sitting at a table with fellow actors and reading, and yet also we're cheering that you mastered it, you did it. And so my question for you, if there is a student watching, and there is, and a student who is struggling, which they are, what could you tell them about overcoming this obstacle, overcoming this adversity?
I think you have to really look at what your passion is, what you really love doing, and focus around that and learn around that. Because then you'll really want to do it. You'll have a reason. What's your goal? What's your objective in that? And then try to go after it. In fact, you know, the wonderful thing now is we have the technology that we didn't have before. We have voice activation, so you can put your thoughts down on paper. And journal keeping is really important. If you look at Marcus Aurelius and Meditations in that book, and this is another thing that I like to get back to, I think it's really important, is the morning writing. Get up in the morning and write how you're feeling. Or just dictate into a tape what it is, and then you edit it on your phone, if you have a phone. If not, someone, you can borrow one. That's an opportunity to get your thoughts and your feelings down on paper, and then you can look at them, and it allows you to release that. So you're not holding on to the emotion of those things and those feelings. You don't necessarily want to send it to a person, you're just doing it for yourself, but do it in the morning and then do an evaluation in the evening. If you can do that, that's a great start. Mm. And you have to understand, everybody is a unique individual, and there's gold in who you are, just being who you are. The problem with Instagram, social media, and all is that you're putting out there a world that is not necessarily attainable for everybody. And it shouldn't be. And you're only seeing one half of the story. You're not seeing the reality. You're just seeing what they want to present to you. So don't compare yourself, as easy as it is, as hard as it is. And I'm saying this as much to myself as I am to you. is we cannot compare ourselves to others. You can compare yourself to another person. If it's a negative thing, it's usually something that you're identifying in yourself that you don't want to look at, and you put it on them. So first ask yourself, what is it that's bothering me about that person that's in me, one? Or what is the great quality that that person has that I want in me, that I can develop? What is that trait? And go about it that way. And remember, you're special for who you are. And it will take you time to find the gold and to harvest it and to bring it out and to polish it. And that's what life is about. It's about perfecting yourself over time.
So before I move on to our next subject, what I want to ask you as a parent, what was that like when you started sensing that one of your sons may process the way you do? Maybe your son was struggling to read those words and hadn't discovered the art of juggling like you did. What was that feeling for you like a parent?
Well, first it was just, I was paralyzed with anxiety, fear. I was overwhelmed with the thought of what I had gone through, and to think that they would have to go through the same thing was just so debilitating at first. Really hard to do anything with my kids in school. At first, I wasn't really conscious of how much of a block I had until it started to really dawn on me that actually, was first my daughter was diagnosed with dyslexia, and we got out in front of it, and it was always something I was concerned about. And thank God, my wife's mother is an educator. She's a teacher, so she could see this stuff very early on. And we've got to get him with a specialist. We got to get her with a specialist. And I think that's your first step, is when you see a student struggling in your classroom, if you have the knowledge and the education to be able to do an evaluation, then you should. If you don't, then take it upon yourself and go, you know what? We need to get this student tested. We need to have a conversation with the parents. And sometimes the parents are too busy. Sometimes the parents are also probably maybe undiagnosed or having their own issues and cannot do it. And it's overwhelming for them. If you find the right specialist to get them tested so you can identify what the issue is, then you can put a program together to help them learn. And that's just the problem with the systems that we have. It's one box fits all, and that's not how we learn. And so that's another question that we can't do right now. So we have to look at how we're educating kids. And if you're in a public school system, it's got to be incredibly challenging. And the fact that you're there is remarkable. Don't give up.
I thank you for saying that.
I know you're overcoming so many things to get into the classroom. And then trying to get the attention of the students, you know, and if you can meet them there and understand what they're individually going through, then you can meet them where they need to be met. And that's part of teaching. And that's time. That's investment in you, in your students emotionally. And that's exhausting.
Absolutely.
And you're going to have to take time for yourself to recover from that and to fill up. Go ahead, sorry.
And I love that you're saying that, because in the film, ironically, one of the things that's difficult oftentimes for teachers when they're watching it is pursuing passion and having a significant other that's not as supportive. And there's a scene in the film that's difficult. Hilary Swank, who plays me, is taking my students out to these field trips, and she's bringing in these guest speakers like Neep Geese, and you don't participate. You don't want to go to see that movie, to go to that museum. And so what the Freedom Writers learned and have continued to do is some of those things that we did in my classroom that were different. Going to see that movie, meeting that woman who saved Anne Frank, allowed us to be lifelong learners, that education doesn't have to be contained in a classroom between bells and whistles and grades. Our story starts when they were in high school. And I want to take our audience to a high school classroom with Patrick Dempsey. Before hair gel, before you got in those beautiful Porsches and Ferraris, you were a high school student. And it was a little awkward. And I want you to paint a picture of Patrick Dempsey, the juggler, and the student that didn't feel as confident as you are now and didn't realize that you had a story to share as you do now.
I was still waiting for puberty to hit me.
I don't think anybody believed you.
Everything was delayed in my life until much later. And then after I got out of high school, my education began in many ways.
Hair? How was the high school Patrick Dempsey hair?
It was big. It was very big without any kind of product in it. So that was the thing that was quite funny. But I did excel in sport, you know, and that's where I could get people. But then I was always struggling because I was always on the verge of failure and not being on the team and some of those, you know, classes that you can't participate in if you don't have your grades. And it was very frustrating for me. And then at that point, it was really kind of covering up and trying to fake my way through knowing things that I didn't know or reading things that I didn't know. And I think it was really very hard. And then you start to act out a little bit more because of that. And then also too, you withdraw and you start to do other things. And at that point there was the shop class. I was doing shop class. So, and I tell this to my kids, I think you definitely, if you get a degree, great, but also do a trade, have both, have something that you can fall back on that you can do with your hands so that you can always work. And this is something that we were talking about today. It's like, whatever it is, have a trade. And my wife has a trade, and it's important. It's important to do that as well as having a degree. And for me, you know, you're starting to talk about colleges at that point in high school and everybody's, and I had no idea what I was going to do. I was struggling in school constantly.
Your Patrick Dempsey of high school is actually our sweet spot. I think that when freedom riders go to a school, they spot the Patrick Dempsey in a corner. The kid that lingers, the kid that's not front and center raising their hand. I think there's something about us that really resonates with you then, the kid that feels invisible or feels on the margins. And that makes me sad that at that time that someone didn't take your hand and say, we're going to get you to the finish line. And so I understand that you didn't graduate with your peers. So what came with that? Was there,
Well, there's a whole story about it. So what happened was in school. So here's the beautiful thing about shop class, home ec, which I don't think happens anymore. But you have these special teachers who are outliers. They're rebels. They're
the mavericks.
Right? That's what you want.
All Freedom Rider teachers are outliers and mavericks.
You have to be. So he was an ex-Green Beret. This is in the 70s in Maine. He had the beard, you know, connected to the earth, and he played the hammer dulcimer. And in shop class, we were all making hammer dulcimers, which are these little instruments that are string instruments that you put on a table and you pound. They're sort of a Celtic instrument. And the power had gone out because it was a storm and we couldn't do anything. So Mr. McKinney started juggling. And I was blown away. I was like, this is amazing. Do it again. There's something about juggling that everybody loves, right? And they find it to be magical. And he taught me. And I picked it up like that. And in that moment, my life changed and it was never the same. Because then I found my out. I got from a small rural community, you know, that was transitioning. It was a mill town. There was not a lot of work. There was a lot of, you know, things that had been but are no longer. So it's the ghost of that. That's the energy. That's sort of the environment you're growing up in. And suddenly I became special because I could juggle and I would learn tricks. And that's how it changed.
I think for your very discerning audience, which I'm sure many women are swooning, you juggle in a lot of roles. I remember you juggled in Enchanted, and I've seen you juggle on Grey's Anatomy. So do you kind of organically work that into your role, or does it just happen on the set?
I think it's usually the directors love it, and they think it's interesting and different. I do have to say that there's some incredible jugglers around the world right now. All over the world. And if you follow IGA, which is the International Jugglers Association, you know, I'll see people who are juggling all around the world on the street. And if I'm like traveling, like I was in Brazil and we stopped at a light and this woman came out and she started juggling and she was performing and doing this incredible routine. And you're like, this is an amazing routine. As a juggler, you're like, this woman has so much technique and she's getting this is how she's making her living. And I go, there for the grace of God, go I, because that could have been me. I could have been that person who was there juggling on the street corner. I know it was. That's how I made money for many years, was to go out and do that.
But I think what I think is interesting for teachers is you clearly are a kinesthetic learner where you have to touch and feel. And
yes.
You're a speaker. I know that with your auto racing, you actually get under the hood. So you tinker. And that's what a lot of kids do that have learning disabilities are visual, they're auditory, and they're kinesthetic, all the things that you do so well. So I wonder if the juggling was a way for you to be a part of something, but also showcase, like, look at me, I have this great gift, I have this great skill.
Yeah, you want to be identified, certainly at that age, right? And I'm seeing with my boys now, at 13, 14, 15, it's about mastery, it's about having your own identity, and like, who am I? What am I? Who can I become? And for me, that was really started to, I was ski racing, I was doing a lot of ski racing, I'd been very successful in the state of Maine, I won the championship, you know, so I was disciplined when I needed to be, but I had to be moving. And that's still how I learn today. Like, if I want to learn something, I'll go to the source and watch and feel and smell and get a sense of it. And then it's in my muscles and then it's in my cells. That's how I learn. And that's the problem is, though, the system isn't set up that way. It's, you know, if you're a square hole and you got this round peg, you got to jam it in there. It doesn't work.
And that's why we're teaching these teachers.
But it also has to happen on a government level. I mean, absolutely. You have to understand, and you have to follow the science is a good thing. It's not a bad thing. We should listen to it. There's the science of diagnosing how people learn. And that's how we should break them down and sort of put them in a classroom. It's like, okay, they're learning in this way. So let's do that. Let's focus on that technique of learning. And then this group will go this way. And then this group will go that way. And then you're empowering people. And you're meeting them where they're at.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think for a lot of your fans, they probably remember high school Patrick riding a lawnmower.
I was Ronald Miller. So I was very much Ronald Miller, the geek. And still, for the most part.
Talk about that. I know you were no longer in high school when you had that really iconic role that kind of burst you on the scene. What was that like to go from a small town in Maine, using your skills to tinker, and then suddenly you're in a movie?
It was really overwhelming, you know, and it took me a long time to figure out how to navigate it. You know, you come from a small town, there are certain values that are there. That you won't necessarily find in a big city like Hollywood. You know, it's a different mentality and it's very fast and it's unforgiving. And it's very heady once you start getting some success. So you go from very much the Ronald Miller, you go from geek to chic, and it's hard to digest that. It's hard to believe in yourself. And if you have any insecurity, you start to have people start to look at you and they're like, well, who are they looking at? This isn't clearly me. This is what I've not been. I'm still the kid who's in the, you know, the special ed classes. And now I'm being told something else. It's very challenging to get your head around to accept
it. I think that's what a lot of Freedomers have faced. They, you know, they were in my class for whatever reason. They had that learning disability. They were a disciplinary transfer. They were that foster kid. And I think when they became published authors and then there was a movie, the way an audience saw them may not be the way they saw themselves. And I love how you said from geek to chic. I don't know if the Freedom Riders think they're chic, but that must be strange for you. And so probably what you see in the mirror is not what we see when we look on the screen. Is that possible?
Oh, I think that is. I think that's right on. And I think here's an example with Derek Shepherd, which is McDreamy. So McDreamy is sort of this idealized male version that all that energy, you're asked to hold that. And I'm a human being, right? I am not perfect. I am deeply flawed like everybody else. We're here because we're not perfect. We're here to refine ourselves. So when you have something like that, you're holding that for people and you have to live up to that. And that's very hard. You have to find a way to realize that you are not that person and that you have to disengage. But yet when you go out, you want to meet that. You want to be able to live to that. So that idea, that's aspirational. So I want to work towards being a better person every day. You know, am I a better person than I was yesterday? Am I a better person tonight than I was this morning? And hopefully the answer is yes, you know, but it's always very challenging because it's a projection. You fall into an archetype. And then also too, the other thing is, are you worthy of this attention? And that question can either really calm you down or freak you out. Or you may not feel worthy and you'll do things to sabotage yourself.
You know, what I love about you, the boy that didn't graduate with your peers, you were Dr. McDreamy and the fine folks from Bowdoin College, where Dr. McDreamy allegedly had got his degree, did a mission to give you your first of two honorary doctorate. So you have two doctorate degrees, one from Bowdoin and one from Bates. So what is that like? You actually now are a doctor, to be able to get those degrees from a university and have that to show your sons and your daughter.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing. And two incredible universities and completely different in identity and what they stand for. And really, Bates was the school that I never went into as a kid. It was something that was unattainable to me. You know, some kids would go and do their senior year at Bates or Bowdoin College. And that was never, ever something that I entertained. That's something that I could ever be at. You know, it's just so up there, you know, and so monolithic and it just over. And then when I got the doctorates in both of those universities, I wished I had understood that I could have done it. So anybody who's out there who is seeing themselves as me at a younger age, you can do it. You're going to have to work hard. But if you want to do it, you can.
So the world stops in March, and you've got a daughter who's a senior that has all of these things looming, proms and graduations, and two middle school boys who probably do everything, sports at all. Parent Patrick does what?
Well, first of all, it was just nice to be isolated with the family and us not running all over the place. So yes, the class of 2020, my heart goes out to them. All of you have gone through so much from the very beginning of your academic careers to now. So much has happened in the world, starting with September 11th, all of the shootings in the high schools. And this was something I asked my daughter. I was like, the thing that you remember, what is it? She goes, the shootings in high schools and schools. Mm. So that's a generation who's really had to come to terms with that and the violence of that. And also the environment and where we're at. None of this, you know, they didn't get to celebrate. They didn't have the ritual of finishing this. And I think ritual is really important. Like, you know, you may think, oh, the prom is not an important thing, but it is. It's a time to come together. It's a time of the community, your peers, where you celebrate and where you hold each other and you dance. That's a beautiful thing. And that was lost. And there's that emptiness and there's that moment in time that only happens once. And my heart went out to her. And, you know, not having graduation. All of those things, the social things, I think in the final year were really, really hard for her. And even now going into freshman year at college, she's not getting that experience. She's doing it in an isolational way. You know, she's being isolated and it really concerns me. And I think the thing that what you're working on is the mental wellness. We don't teach that in school. And that's something we should teach. How do you control your mind? Which leads me to this book I'm going to recommend right now. It's a perfect segue if I can. The other thing was like, what are we doing with our kids? How do we educate them? What do we do to give them the tools? Thank God I had the right, we had everything in place so that they could learn virtually. I had special, you know, teachers with math and tutors and things like that, because it's not something I am capable of doing. So I wanted to find a specialist to help them in whatever it was that they need and ask them, what do you need for me to help you? Okay. I'm not in your head. What do you need me to help you with? What can I help you? And that's how we began the summer. And then the summer was really about how much freedom you get. How much time can you go out with your peers? And then you have your pod people where you're safe and are you responsible? And then reading books on tape for me has been the way I really am well listened. I'm not well read, but I'm well listened. And a book that I picked up and I really love, because I talked about Marcus Aurelius. I was working in Rome last year on a show called Devils, which is coming out in a few weeks. I was in Rome. What an opportunity for me to learn. I had a teacher, a professor, an art historian, take myself and my daughter around Rome, one-on-one, and we had a history lesson.
So it's art.
So through that, I started to learn about Marcus Aurelius in the writings of meditation, which led me to finding this book called The Daily Stoic. And the author is Ryan Holiday. Ryan Holiday, I reached out to this week, and he does a program that I think you should check into, which is you can use the Stoic principles on a daily basis, and it really helps you. And I invite you all to get this or download it and to listen to it. This book in particular is written several. One is to overcome. How do you overcome obstacles? And there is real liberation in that. But But I highly recommend this book and other writings by Ryan Holiday.
So my question for you as a parent who was home with your kids, was it interesting for you to go back to school again? Were you?
No, it was horrendous. It was painful to relive it. It wasn't something fun. I don't want to go and be young again. I'm very happy being the age I am. You know, no question about that. But I am enjoying being a father and learning how to, you know, admit what I don't know and then finding out someone who does know. And that's okay. And that's part of being a parent, is not, you don't have to have all the answers, you know, but you can go to people, you can put a team around you. The one thing I learned through racing and through sport is you have a team, create a team. And the same goes for educating your children and improving yourself. It's like, put the team around you that you want. And that's what it was, really listening to them on the emotional side. What did the kids need? You know, and it's really the social aspect at this point was really affecting everybody. We didn't have a problem with the technology and the teachers were in place. I mean, we had struggled in the last couple of years, we've struggled heavily and we're suddenly turning the corner.
You know what I think is so interesting about you that I applaud is you're so self-aware. There's a great humility. And I think when you have that ability to be humble and self-aware, that you can pivot on a dime, which I see that you clearly do, and you can model that for your sons and daughter. And I think what was hard for so many kids in this kind of virtual learning space was the isolation, and then all that came with it, the depression, the anxiety, not being able to have a team. And so I think that's why the Freedomers felt, they rallied because they felt like I was at that place as a teenager, and mm-hmm. I don't want somebody to go down a rabbit hole. I don't want somebody to have suicidal thoughts, because there's something about our story where we often are the place where people are outreached to. You know, we get that letter of somebody on a ledge. We get that letter of someone who takes that razor blade and cuts too deep. So I love that the Freedom Riders who have been there in a dark place realize how important it is to be light. And I think that's really, in the roles that you assume, I think you always are light. And do you feel that you're attracted to those kinds of roles where you can be light and self-aware?
Well, yeah, I think it's important to be positive, you know, but it's also important. Look, I have my questions and I go into the darkness too. And I've had those moments where you're looking at the edge and you're going, why am I here? You know, this is just, but you have to remember one thing that's important, impermanence. Impermanence and change, that you can, that is going to happen in life. Life is about change and how you can adapt to change. And usually right when you get comfortable and you think you've got this covered, you're going to have to change again. And that's okay. Make change friend. That's what you want to do. And think of it, that's how you grow. And I have self-awareness because I've been knocked down and I was forced to have self-awareness because of the mistakes I've made. You know, I've been on this planet for 50 some odd years now, so I've made a lot of mistakes. I have a certain amount of life experience, and there are a lot of things I want to learn and I need to continue to learn. But you get knocked down. You will get the lesson. Either you'll learn it the hard way or you'll learn it the easy way.
Mm, I love it. There was another thing that you mentioned earlier when you and I were speaking about what you learned was being a good partner. You know, in the Freedom Riders film, I go to juvenile halls every Christmas. And I have to tell you, those boys in that juvenile hall, they don't like you. And it's not that they don't like you. They don't like the character you played, because they always ask me, is that part of the movie real? And did your husband really leave? And suddenly you become this archetype of someone who wasn't supportive, but you are so supportive of your wife. And so can you tell our viewers who are in relationships what you learned about that give and take and that support? Because in the film, I think the line you said was, I can't be your wife. And you hear audible gasps when you said it on the screen, but you are very much your wife's partner and her equal. So how did you learn that?
Well, we've gone through a lot. So we've been married for over 20 years now. We've had our good times and our bad times. We come into it with our, you know, when you come into a relationship, you have, like, I'm carrying all the stuff that we just talked about, you know, about the shame of my education, about my intelligence, my family dynamics, and your partner has that as well. And sometimes, there are these underlying things. If you aren't working with a therapist, you aren't getting in there and getting to work. It's like anything. It's like you have to work on it. And there are specialists out there. Go and work through these psychological issues. And in relationships, if you don't deal with them, you're going to repeat them. So you have to kind of go, okay, am I going to stay in this? Am I going to fight this out? Am I going to get in there when I need to? And when you take your vows, you have to go and you got to do that. And we had a little bit of a break, but we realized that we're going to work through our issues. And I think as a partner, you're not going to agree on everything, and you're not going to want the same things, but that's okay. This concept of happy ever after doesn't work that way. You can have happiness, but it takes work. It's like you have to tend it. You have to allow your partner to go, what do you need for your own personal growth, separate from me, separate from the kids? What's your own individual desire? And finding a way to support that and to be able to communicate that. And then you have a relationship that starts to blossom, but it's challenging. But like you in the story, you had a higher calling, and you may not be aware of it, but you're being pulled because you have something to say and something to do. And sometimes as a partner, you miss your partner because that love is going somewhere else. It's not coming home. And you have to really work on yourself to love yourself. You need to be able to self-care, and you have to control your mind and the thoughts and your feelings. And you have to give a space for your partner to go off and do their own thing.
I think that's really a beautiful pattern that you've had is, you know, you did self-care before you knew it was a thing. It's a buzzword now, but it wasn't when we were growing up. And I love that.
I got turned on to a lot of interesting things early on. Robert Johnson was a Jungian doctor. He wrote He, She, and We. There are these really fascinating archetypes, breaking it down from a Jungian philosophy. And I really got into that early on in my probably 18 or 19. And I would go to lectures. And I would listen to lectures. And that's how I started to learn. And that was really exciting for me. So my education began once I dropped out of school, because then I started studying things I wanted to study.
That's for every teacher. They love that. It's an example of it's never too late. It's like the marathon, not the sprint. So Dr. McDreamy, I want to showcase a scholarship they were so proud to give, which is going to cue up something incredible that you did in honor of your mom. One of my beautiful Freedom Riders, just like you, it was the marathon, not the sprint. She is going to be a doctor, like a medical doctor. And it didn't seem possible for her. She was undocumented and didn't know that she could actually go all the way. And she did. She graduated from college. She has beautiful kids who are now following in her footsteps. And when I thought about you tonight, I thought about one of the most amazing gifts that you have given is back in your community, the Dempsey Center that really specializes in cancer awareness in honor of your mom. And so you were that Dr. McDreamy. You have those honorary doctorates, but you believe in philanthropy. So can you talk about why it was so important for you to honor your mom, how hard she worked? I know she was a school secretary, and to do something in your hometown that raised you to leave something that was permanent.
Absolutely. My mom had a really long battle with ovarian cancer, over 12 reoccurrences. It was over 15 years, you know, and we lost her a few years ago. But in that, you know, sort of the Grey's Anatomy took off and people were asking you, what's your charity? What do you believe in? What do you stand for? And I'd never been asked that question before, you know. And at the time, I was working with the Amgen Tour of California, which is a bike event. And the component was the Breakaway from Cancer Initiative. And it had prevention, and they had this group in there, integrative medicine. I was like, what is that? So they don't treat the disease, they treat the person. And I'm like, this is what we need in my community. Mm. And can you make real change? Yes, you can. All you have to do is look out your back door or your front door, and you can make a difference in your community. You don't have to worry about taking over the world. Just do something. What is the need in your community? And can you help it? And can you fulfill that need? Or can you put a group together? And that's how it came about. What could we do to help my mother through her journey, supporting her on the psycho and the social aspect which is what's really needed. And I believe the work that's being done at the center and other centers that are like-minded throughout the country is that integrative medicine should go hand in hand. As soon as someone is diagnosed, you should be working on the mindfulness approach to the disease, because it's relentless and it hits everybody. It's such a profound impact on the family that we support the caregiver and the family and the children. There are different groups. We work on nutrition. We work on the physical aspect through yoga and meditation, and then support groups. And then whatever else that person needs, what can we do to make your life better? You ask that question, you never know what you're going to get for an answer. Then you try to fulfill that. And what I've learned is the meaning of life is about philanthropic work and having empathy. No matter how much money you make, you still have to look at yourself in the mirror, and you're still that person in the special ed class. You may be able to buy your way out of it for a while, but you're going to hit the wall at some point. You're going to come back to that. But when you start to do something for someone else and you feel what that feels like, that is what life is about.
Oh my gosh. Well, Patrick, my hope for you, honestly, is that we can instill this wonderful recording, have teachers who want to get continuing education credit to be able to start with you, to say, I can use his words and his story as something that's aspirational for my students. So I'm really hopeful to use this to pay forward, to make teachers bigger and bolder and better. And I just thank you for all of your passion, for honoring your mom, for going to where your kids are at, and for making people around the globe so happy with each and every role that you undertake. So thank you.
Thank you very much. And it's very humbling to hear all this. And it's really beautiful to be a part of this with you, even though it wasn't the strongest of the characters in the sense, but it's an important one, because you'll always have that negative voice that will try to stop you, and you can't listen to it because they're threatened by it. And it's okay. Go on. Don't listen to those voices. And look at this movement that you have created with your passion and your desire. You knew deep down inside that it was the right thing to do when people told you it wasn't. And I think everything is so easy sometimes that you don't realize that you have to have adversity in life in order to appreciate the good times. And that life is about overcoming that. And that's why we're here. And it's okay. Don't run against it. Embrace it. And certainly with the land of COVID that we're in right now, there's something in this in time that will be very good for us. It's just hard to see. And when we run into people, they need to know that they are loved. And I had this encounter on an elevator today, going to see someone. And I wanted that person to go first and to give them the space. And it was like a transformative moment that this person was like, oh my God, you're kind. And I'm like, yes. And it's like, that's what we need to do with each other right now. And it's so scary. It's so easy to lose your temper because there's so much happening. But come from your heart. And if you stay there, you'll always be safe. And you'll always do the right thing.
I'm so grateful to our guest, Patrick Dempsey, for being so open and so honest about his learning disabilities and struggles in school. My dear listeners, may each of us look for ways to make our world and our classrooms more inclusive. May we strive to show kindness and compassion to all those we encounter. And in honor of our guest, Patrick Dempsey, may we all support students regardless of their circumstances. Today's episode was originally part of our Toast for Change fundraiser. If you'd like to watch this event in its entirety, please follow the link in this episode's show notes. Once again, I'm your host, Erin Gruwell. This episode was produced and edited by Matt Martin Hall and Rob Falk, with production assistance by Brendan Falk. Until next time, dear listeners, may you write what needs to be written and tell what needs to be told.